Hello and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, how are you doing today?
Brian, I'm super as always, but this time I actually mean it.
Sean, I'm looking at you from across a very long table.
Yes.
It's as if we are Citizen Kane and whoever that other woman is on the breakfast scene in Citizen Kane. I expect our marriage to deteriorate slowly over a long montage.
Well, all I can say, Brian, is that I'm finally glad we can do this while looking at each other.
Now, why is this? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you may have in the past on Broad Appeal heard the distant sounds of sirens, car alarms, stabbings, that sort of thing, because we normally record in an urban wasteland, but today we're somewhere else.
Yes, we're on the coast in beautiful Worthing, which has one of the oldest populations in the UK. Now, if you may hear the rattling of stones behind you, no, it's not gemstones, even though we are surrounded by gemstones, it's the gentle clacking of ice cubes in a gin and tonic.
Yes, spring is truly here, isn't it, Sean? The sound of the waves, the squawking of seagulls, the blooming of daffodils. We are house-sitting, ladies and gentlemen, and we've brought our podcasting equipment with us.
Yes, we have affluent friends who are not in their home.
It's a bit like having the Wilcoxes for your friends, you know?
And they are, again,
Howard's End, darling, mm-hmm. Howard's End.
It's always Howard's End for you, isn't it?
Think it over, Helen, or we shall not have happy lives. You've brought two starving people from London to Shropshire.
To Worthing, darling, Worthing.
Worthing. All right, so that was absolutely incorrect. There is no way that I should have been doing an Emma Thompson impression. We are going to be talking about an actress who is even more erudite and is one of the leadingest of all leading ladies currently working in Hollywood. That woman is Cate Blanchett, the good, the bad, and the crazy.
Yeah, like all good actresses, she has her fair share of shit and gold.
Yeah, the thing about Cate Blanchett when she's bad, she kind of is bad with relish.
Yeah, she's bad with aplomb.
Now, of course, we've already covered Cate Blanchett once in a movie which arguably is bad.
Yes.
And a movie in which arguably she is sort of bad in. Well, she's certainly a bad-hearted character. That movie is Notes on a Scandal, where she plays Sheba Hart, the languorous pedophiliac teacher. That episode focused far more on Judi Dench.
Yeah.
Like, the thing about Cate Blanchett that I have grown to really admire and to really love is, like, she can be an absolutely impeccable and amazing actress, but she also can be trashy, she can be campy,
she can be villainous,
she could just throw herself into an accent that is, you know, dialed up about 17 notches further than it needs to go.
Yeah. I mean, she can also be super villainous, let's not forget. The last Cate Blanchett film that I saw in the cinema was Thor Ragnarok.
Does she wear sort of like antlers in that?
Yes, she plays Hela.
Oh, yeah. The Norse goddess.
Yeah, remember, Thor's all about Norse gods.
Oh, yeah.
Duh. So she plays Hela, and she has horns. She has some Philip Tracy headgear.
She's hella crazy.
Yeah, she is. Good one. Good one.
So I take it that you admired her in that. Have you always admired Cate Blanchett?
Now, Brian, that's quite a long answer. Do you want to hear it?
Oh, sure. We've got time.
Okay. My appreciation for Cate Blanchett has developed over time. I feel like I've known of her for as long as I've known of any actress, really. I think I learned to dislike her because I had to watch the trailer for Charlotte Gray about 15 times one particular summer. It's like every film that I went to see was her on her bicycle as Charlotte Gray. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to see this film. Why is it here?
It's funny because I actually have another distinct memory of a trailer for Cate Blanchett in a film that I've never seen, which is Oscar and Lucinda, mm-hmm. which is one of her earliest films.
Yeah, it's her third film, I think.
This was the kind of trailer that was always on the VHS before the late 90s movie that you were planning to watch, probably produced by Harvey Weinstein, there was Oscar and Lucinda with Ralph Fiennes, a Cate Blanchett, trying to, like, sail a cathedral down a river somewhere in Australia.
That's what it's about.
That's what it's about, yeah. It's kind of based on some kind of goofy novel.
It's one of those things where if you just put a person's name as the title of the film, it really gives absolutely nothing away.
It could literally be about anything.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, like, here was this woman who, you know, she was a pretty young Australian woman, but, like, who is she? And then suddenly, Cate Blanchett was everywhere. I remember reading a big profile of her in The New Yorker that was saying, look, she's all over our screens, she's starring on stage in London in David Hare's play Plenty, and there was this kind of sense that she is the newest actress's actress. But it took me a little while to really get aboard the Cate Blanchett bandwagon. And I think it's sort of akin to what you were saying as well. Why do you think we have this skepticism of her?
So for me, I didn't see Charlotte Gray, and I didn't see the talent of Mr. Ripley, but I did see, you know, the box in Kieran's video shop for something like Bandits. And I had to sit through her as Galadriel in three Lord of the Rings films. And I kind of just thought, okay, this is the woman that people are going crazy about? And then when it came to Blue Jasmine, only really a few years ago, I went with my friend Ruth and I said, do you want to go see this new Woody Allen film? It stars Cate Blanchett. And she was like, yeah, love Cate Blanchett. Who doesn't? And I thought to myself, oh, I don't think I love her. Am I in the minority here?
Wait, here's my question. I get that you're saying you didn't love her, but what was your hesitation? Like, did you think she was too snooty? She was like, what was the thing that you instinctively resisted?
I would have said then that she seems a bit ethereal, a bit cold, a little bit haughty. Maybe some of the films that I'm supposed to like her in, Elizabeth, also received a lot of heavy rotation on TV. I kind of thought, oh great, it's just another costume drama. And regular listeners to this podcast will know that I am very suspicious of all costume dramas until I see them.
Well, I have to say, I had this moment with Cate Blanchett. I didn't see Elizabeth immediately when it came out, but maybe a year or two later, I finally watched it. And of course, we're going to talk about it later in the episode. She is young. She commands that film. She is authoritative. And maybe a week later, I saw The Talented Mr. Ripley. Something about seeing those two performances as a 1-2 punch, one right after the other, I thought to myself, who is this person who can be a 16th century monarch and look literally like a Holbein painting come to life, and then can be a kind of mid-century aristocrat who's walking around comically saying things like, Dickie Greenleaf, it's so marvelous to see you. And that is the thing that I have just come to love about Cate Blanchett, is she is totally game. She's game for anything. And so I have no doubt, for instance, that she's great in Thor Ragnarok. I have no doubt that she'll, like, call up Steven Spielberg and be like, sure, I can do cod Russian accent in Crystal Skull. What is the problem?
She was a Nazi in that.
Yeah, she said, I thought she was Russian.
I thought she was a Nazi.
Well, whatever she was, she had some ludicrous accent. And I have absolutely no doubt that she's going to be hilarious and campy and sexy and cool in Ocean's 8 when that comes out later this year.
Well, just to build on your kind of 1-2 punch, I think I saw Blue Jasmine and Notes on a Scandal in a short period of time. You know, the thing about Blue Jasmine is that it's both the interesting portrait of an affluent woman crumbling, it's also kind of campy, and I guess the same thing could be said about Notes on a Scandal. So up until that point, I obviously thought she was cold, icy, ethereal, whatever. And then I see these two films that correct me pretty quickly.
Here's the thing about, like, both those performances. Like, I'm not the biggest fan of Blue Jasmine. I have to admit, like, in many ways, the film is ludicrous and inauthentic. And, like, you're just like, is this even taking place in the real world where the wife of a millionaire has never used a computer?
Yeah, that is the hardest part of that film for me. Because, like, you can tell that a man who's, like, in his 70s and who never uses technology or a computer has made this film. I was sitting there in the Curzon Soho being like, wait, is someone going to, like, take her aside and be like, wait, you can't use the computer? Do you know what I mean? And then when she goes to computer class, there's also, like, a young person there as well. So I did a lot of head-scratching during Blue Jasmine.
So you have to accept that Blue Jasmine takes place in even further of a remove of alternative reality than most real movies. But then there are lines like, I love pewter. And you just are like, you win me over, Kate Blanchett, because you can take a banal line like, I love pewter, and literally make me cackle aloud in the ritzy cinema to the degree that everyone turns and is like, why is that funny?
Yeah, well, that's because there obviously wasn't enough gay men in that audience.
Even my gay friend, Andrew, who was with me, was like, why is that funny?
You know, I came out of Blue Jasmine talking to my friend, being like, but she had an iPhone, and she could use it. What's, like, that was the real deal breaker for that film.
Okay, that's more Woody's problem than Kate's.
Okay.
But here's the thing about Kate Blanchett. Like, I think the more we talk about it, it's really worth noting that despite her titanic run here in movies for, you know, it's got to be like 20 plus years, right? Now
that
she's been, that she's been in movies, and even though there have been some lulls, she really keeps delivering with nominations and acclaimed performances in many different genres. But all through the time that she's been doing that, she's also been regularly appearing on stage on like three continents.
Yeah.
She and her husband, Andrew Upton, ran the Sydney Theatre Company for a really long time, which of course she talked about in her second Oscar speech. I think part of why I like Cate Blanchett is that she is a theatre actress and a film actress. And by that I mean that a theatre actress to me is someone who just loves putting on some makeup and playing a part that is not her. Putting on an accent and being like, who is this character? Who is Masha in The Three Sisters? Who is, you know, Blanche arriving from Bellerive, which apparently is part of what inspired Blue Jasmine? Like, she just has that, like, transformative quality that a lot of film actresses will narrow down the range of what they do. Even, and frankly, like, even someone like Julianne Moore, who we have praised, like, enormously, she's not going to be, like, totally bonkers the way that Cate Blanchett is going to be.
Interesting as well, because I often said that Julianne Moore reminds you that acting is a craft, okay? But Cate Blanchett kind of reminds you that acting is also an industry, and that she kind of creates the infrastructure for acting to take place, which is, you know, why I think her involvement with her husband in the Sydney Theatre Company is so interesting and actually makes her quite singular in terms of acting.
And she also, you know, she's been great for, like, promoting Australian talent. I mean, like, it's thanks to her, I think, that, like, she promotes the likes of Jackie Weaver and people like that, and she kind of constantly returns to the other Australian character actors like Hugo Weaving and all those people to act in her kind of stuff. Like any great theater actress, she does sometimes seem like she's playing to the back row.
Yeah.
And I can understand how that irritates certain people, like certain times. But maybe sometimes the characters that she takes on are just kind of larger than life. They are. She's really good, right? With those kind of like aristocrats who just are, you know, women who have a glamorous facade that somehow we have to see underneath. And they just feel like they've been flung out of space.
Yeah, well, you love Carol, don't you? Can we get the Carol part out of the way now, please?
There's a whole episode from that Oscar year where I talk all about Carol.
Okay,
like,
do you know what? You're right. Just come back to this.
I freaking love Carol, but I mean, I mostly, to be honest, love it for Rooney Mara. I think Rooney Mara was a revelation to me. But, like, that's what I mean about Cate Blanchett. She is somewhat patrician. It's sort of no surprise that she ended up winning her first Oscar for playing an actress, and that actress being Katharine Hepburn. I know you haven't seen The Aviator. Do you remember, actually, when Katharine Hepburn died? She was one of those people, obviously, because she'd won four Oscars, who they don't just put her in the in memoriam montage. They give her her own special moment at the Oscars. Do you remember who announced that montage?
Well, I'm guessing it wasn't Cate Blanchett.
It wasn't, because Cate Blanchett wasn't yet a big enough star, although I think she had already been cast in The Aviator.
Okay, can you give me some hints, please?
It's an actress that we very recently covered. Like, last week.
Oh, God. Angela Bassett.
Julia Roberts.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Julia fucking Roberts. Now, I just want to just take a moment to think about the mismatch here, okay? Katharine Hepburn has died. You bring out Julia Roberts to, like,
no way.
Yeah,
no
so why way. Is that? Why is that wrong?
Katharine Hepburn was an actress, and Julia Roberts is a star.
Totally and completely. Like, now think Katharine Hepburn, Kate Blanchett, or rather Kate Hepburn, Kate Blanchett. It's just a match made in heaven, why is that?
Well, it's also visually as well.
Visually, they have that kind of horsey quality that's, like, beautiful but slightly equine.
I don't think it's horsey at all. I think that Kate Blanchett has quite a cat-like quality, but I'm talking about, like, a Siamese cat or something. Because if you notice, her eyes are actually quite sunken back in her head. Like, I think the Kate Blanchett's resting face is quite intense.
I will say this. Maybe the reason that I compare her to a horse is because I've actually seen her live on stage. She is a tall, striking, dominant presence. So this was in the Sydney Theatre Company's production of Hedda Gabler, which was not great. Mm-hmm. But she was just, like, towering above everyone else. And, of course, Hedda Gabler is also this kind of role that she excels at, which is kind of like over-dramatized, slightly artificial, and then we kind of watch her facade crumble, you know? She appeared at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, in Hedda Gabler the year after she'd won her first Oscar for The Aviator. Now, Clever Brian, of course, lived right around the corner at the time in Fort Greene, and there was no way I wasn't going to go see Cate Blanchett, but I looked at the calendar of performances and I said, oh my goodness, she has a Sunday matinee on the very same day that the Oscars are going on. She's not going to go to the Oscars this year, even though she was the previous year's winner.
For The Aviator, wasn't it?
Yeah, so if she'd won the year before for The Aviator, she was not going to go the next year to present Best Supporting Actor. And I thought to myself, what's Cate Blanchett going to do on the night of the Oscars? This is a perfect opportunity for me to invite her to my annual Oscar party.
And did you?
I did, Sean. I actually did.
How?
Okay, I'm going to explain my clever plan. Now, first of all, literally, I need to point out that the Brooklyn Academy of Music was literally two blocks away, okay, from where I was living at the time. Like, it was just a hop, skip, and a jump. Okay. I assumed I was going to see her at the local bodega, you know, like buying some V8.
Enough with the V8 already.
That's how she has all that equine quality. It's all those vitamins.
Oh, God, Brian, don't do it again.
So I was like, I'll send her a note at the stage door, and I'll include my phone number, and everyone dissuaded me from this. People were like, no, don't put your phone number. They will think you're a crazy stalker, and they might actually even call the police. So I didn't do that. Instead, what I did was, I bought a bouquet of flowers, and I put a note inside saying that we knew you were performing. I'm sure you have somewhere to go on the night of the Oscars, but just to let you know, down the road, there's a bunch of movie fans who think you're really the best, and if you, like, needed something to do, like, you could always come around to our place to watch the Oscars. Now, Sean.
Oh my God, can I just say, you are a loser, okay? That is one of the most loserish things you've ever told me.
Do you know what is an even bigger loser thing? Doing a bi-weekly podcast talking about this shit. But anyway, there we go.
Touché.
So, yes.
Touché, bitch.
Yeah, calling the kettle black much, Mr. Pot? Anyway, so the thing is, in my wildest dreams, did I expect that Cate Blanchett was actually going to come to my Brooklyn apartment? No. Did I think I might get a note back from her? Maybe from, like, her assistant? Did I think maybe in my wildest dreams she'd, like, call me from Harvey Weinstein's party and be like, guys, hello, how are you? I'm watching as Brokeback Mountain loses to Crash. God, oh. You know, something like that? None of that happened. I didn't get a single response.
Yes, of course none of it happened.
I spent a lot on that bouquet.
Well, that is your fault.
Not even a thank you note, Sean?
No, darling.
Ugh.
It was incinerated on arrival.
Richard, why did we come here? So you, from that moment on, I have to say I had a little dip in Cate Blanchett admiration because I thought she just wasn't polite.
Do you know what else? Those flowers never even made it near her dressing room.
Yeah, so fucking stage door Johnny swept them up for himself. You know, I've seen Follies. I know what goes on. Anyway, yeah, my admiration for her dipped a little bit, but it has consistently kept returning. Every time that Cate feels like she's plateauing a bit, she does something new, she does something different. And I have to say, she seems like a genuinely cool person with actually, like, really good taste. Do you agree with me?
I do.
How many other, like, major actress movie stars do you think would do a good job of being the president of the jury at Cannes, which she is about to become?
Julianne Moore would.
Can you see Julianne Moore, like, really leading a group of people?
Yes, I can. Yeah. Yes, I can.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I believe you.
Angela Bassett.
Yeah.
Yeah. Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, Barbara Streisand would exert exactly the kind of collaborative spirit that she did when she made the entire crew of Yentl sign a letter saying how much they loved her. True story.
They signed that willingly, you know. People love making the film. They loved it. I'm not nuts, I'm telling you.
Back to Cannes, which is, of course, coming up in a few weeks. I just think Cate Blanchett is someone who, like, yes, she's an actress, she's a movie star, she, you know, shills out for fashion brands and perfumes and everything.
Yeah, Estée Lauder, isn't it? Is that her? Or is that Julia?
No, isn't she, like, Armani?
Lancôme.
I think she's Armani. Julia's Lancôme.
Maybe it's Elizabeth Arden. Yeah, look it up. I feel love.
It's Armani.
So what is it, Brian?
It's Giorgio Armani C, which translates as yes. And I say yes. I say yes to Cate Blanchett. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, even though she does all those things, she does all the trappings of celebrity, you kind of feel like she's going to be equally at home talking with, like, auteurist directors from Russia.
Which she will be, of course, with Andrei Zagantsev on the jury.
Yeah, that's going to be quite a jury.
Yeah.
Director of your favorite film, Loveless.
Yeah.
As well as Ava DuVernay in there, and sometime lesbian Kristen Stewart.
You know, I have high hopes. Obviously, every year at Cannes is determined by the quality of the films, let alone the jury, you know? Cate Blanchett strikes me as the type of person who would have awarded the Palme d'Or to BPM and not The Square.
Jury presidents don't have complete control, because Pedro definitely wanted to give BPM the top
prize.
Yeah,
but Will Smith didn't want to be associated with anything gay.
Yeah, Scientology. Yeah. Xenu would strike him down.
Yeah.
Okay, enough of the con scuttlebutt. Let's get back to Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
So we are going to talk about Elizabeth in a minute. Can we just kind of have any kind of summation here? I detect that while we admire her and we enjoy seeing her, she doesn't, like, inspire the same heart-pounding passion that we have for Julianne and Isabelle.
You know, I think the older that Cate Blanchett gets, the more I'm willing to appreciate her. Her name is synonymous with a level of quality and interest. And so the fact that she was in Thor Ragnarok told me instantly, okay, it's not just another boring-ass piece of shit film.
Like The Hobbit.
Okay, fine, right, you got me there. There's no reason why she should have been in any of those Hobbit films.
But then she'll go and do something like that weird-ass art film, Manifesto.
Manifesto, yeah.
Yeah, where she plays, like, 17 different roles based on, like, the futurists and the symbolists or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah. Books and things.
Are you going to go see her when she plays Margot Channing?
Darling, don't ask stupid questions. The completely prolific Ivo van Hove is directing a production of All About Eve at the Barbican in a year or something. And she is starring as Margot Channing. So expect lots of, like, weird walking around the stage and, you know, movement.
They'll probably be in a sand pit or something.
Yeah. Yeah, so I will go and see it.
The more we talk about it, there's a level of artificiality that she brings. So she is kind of perfect for Margot Channing, right? Being an actress, being a person who's playing a part. Could anyone else really live up to Bette Davis's Margot Channing?
Well, also, she's the perfect age to play it, because, as we know, Margot Channing was 44. Oh.
And I'm still on one side of that myself.
Exactly.
When I cross that threshold, darling, just fasten your seatbelt, because it's going to be a bumpy night. All right. Speaking of bumpy times, there's been no time bumpier than England during the 16th century, as it went back and forth from monarch and religion and off with their heads and burned at the stake all the time. Of course, I'm talking about Cate Blanchett's first Oscar nomination as the titular monarch in Elizabeth.
You know, Brian, this would have been one of those films where first of all, I would never have watched it if it were not for this podcast. But if I had to watch it and I could choose either maybe you or my best friend to watch this film with, I think actually I'd choose you in this instance. I should bear in mind that you and my best friend are not the same people.
So what you're saying is, when there's a movie that you think you probably won't like and will hate, you'd rather watch it with me?
Also, yes, that's true.
Why is that?
Because also, if there's a film where I need certain things to be explained to me, like, who's her mother and why is she here? And wait, who's that? And is she killing her? Or, wait, why do they hate each other?
Well, the reason
and
why...
France? What does France have to do with this?
The reason why anybody in these movies ever hates each other is because one is a Protestant and one is a Catholic, right?
Yes.
Nominally. Yes, it's true. I did watch Elizabeth with the vantage of having spent 2 years immersed in Elizabethan and Jacobean history and literature.
Where?
At Wadham College, Oxford.
Yes, of course.
When I was researching Elizabethan theatre practice. You know, for me, Sir Francis Walsingham isn't exactly a new name. You know, Lord Burley, Lord Dudley. I know them all. I know who they are.
I've hung with them. I know those people.
We've shared our doublets together. So, shall I just give a brief potted history of, like, what the moment that the film Elizabeth is covering historically?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So we all know A Man for All Seasons, like Henry VIII, he took England away from the Catholic Church.
Because
Sean was very upset about that. Sean wishes that everyone was in allegiance to the Catholic Church still. Am I right?
Moving on.
Anyway, we don't want to cause an international incident. So yeah, Henry VIII, of course, took Britain away. But the problem was, as we all know, that he had real trouble siring a male heir. And that's where there were all those wives, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived, right? And he actually had two daughters first, Mary and Elizabeth. And then he ended up having a son, but the son was very sickly. He reigned for a very brief period of time and he died. And he left these two sisters. Mary was the oldest one, and she, at the start of the film, is the monarch in charge. Who plays Mary in the film Elizabeth?
Kathy Burke. Great casting. Now, as you and I both know, that any depiction of Mary and Elizabeth in either history or in art, Elizabeth is young and healthy with flowing red hair, and Mary is a wizened old crone.
Now, this is definitely one of those situations of, like, history is written by the victors,
yeah.
Right? Because obviously England became a proudly Anglican and Protestant nation, and Elizabeth went on to become perhaps its most significant monarch.
Until this current one.
But, I mean, still, Elizabeth I is pretty much, like, the most significant, right? It's interesting, actually, that the longest-serving monarchs in Britain have all been female. Elizabeth I, Victoria, and now Elizabeth II.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real frickin' matriarchy, isn't it, this nation?
Isn't it?
That's a conversation for another day. Dennis? But anyway, so what was I saying? History written by the victors, right? So she becomes so significant. So of course she's depicted as if she's beautiful and eternally wise. And like Mary is depicted as like little more than a sort of pudgy troll, I would say.
When I look at you, I see nothing of the king. Only that whore, your mother. My father never did anything so well as to cut off her head.
Your Majesty forgets he was also my father.
Why will you not confess your crimes against me?
Because, Your Majesty, I have committed none.
You speak with such sincerity. I see you are still a consummate actress.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, Catholicism for me is the fun one and Protestantism is the cup of tea and rich tea biscuits.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to just dive into this a little bit. So
I don't want to be sectarian here, okay? I grew up far enough away from the border not to have this in me.
We don't have equal balance here on the podcast.
No.
You and I are both very, very much Catholic boys. And I have to admit that, like, this movie, while incredibly fun as cinema, I think plays a bit fast and loose with history.
Well, who directed it?
It is directed by someone named Shekhar Kapoor.
Yes.
We looked up, he's an Indian filmmaker, and most of his movies have actually been made in India, in Bollywood.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have a big English language career. It's fascinating that he was picked to make this movie because it does have a truly OTT quality to it.
Well, can I just say, this film is a prime example of why more films need to be made by non-white directors or non-Western directors, or people who are not already part of the system, because you get an entire different way of looking at the story.
Well, it's like that genius thing that we said when Ang Lee comes to direct Sense and Sensibility, or even when the dear departed Milos Forman is doing Amadeus or something, right? You have someone from another culture who's kind of observing what they see around them with a kind of outsider's eye through a kind of window, and they can see systems, they can see iconography in a totally different way. Yeah?
Mm.
This movie, Elizabeth, is totally in love with all the iconography of monarchy and church and religion and torture and glamour and all that kind of stuff,
yeah, and
right?
Peace and war and reconciliation. Yeah. Yeah.
And that the color scheme is very much that, like, when the Catholics are in charge in this movie, they are dour and they are dressed in black and everything is shadowy and bad.
They're villainous. It's like they're in a fucking bat cave. Like, I was, like, looking at this with Brian and being like, this doesn't look like a Catholic church at all.
And let's be honest, like, it probably was the other way around, because, like, the Protestants were the ones who were, like, smashing icons, and, like, eventually the Puritans were wearing sober black robes, whereas the Catholics
were decorous and decadent.
Now, granted, Elizabeth ultimately falls somewhere in between, because she kind of unifies the people around the Anglican church, which followed the Protestant theology, but definitely adopted some of the trappings of the high church. You know, yes. That was kind of the compromise that she was able to create.
Isn't high Anglican very, very similar to Catholicism?
Well, exactly right. And that's the sort of thesis of the movie, yeah, is that we meet Elizabeth at a time when she is kind of waiting in the wings to become queen, because Mary is old and sickly. She hasn't produced an heir. She's actually married to the King of Spain, who is a Catholic. The Protestants really don't like this, and they want to get Elizabeth there in the throne to get the Protestants in charge, right?
Yeah.
And there's this kind of war back and forth throughout the film, Catholic and Protestant, Spain and France, vying for who's going to control England. And as Richard Attenborough kind of shuffles on and gives us some great historical exposition.
Yeah, a very red-faced Richard Attenborough.
He really looks
like
ruddy.
He's so red. Like, yeah. Was he drinking a lot before his...
I don't know. He's exerting himself on, you know, the elliptical machine.
Like, he was so red.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing redder in the film is Josephine's luscious lips, which honestly look like they've been done up by Lancôme.
No, Fanny Ardant has more... Basically, Fanny Ardant's makeup is just like a regular woman in 2018.
Okay, but what I'm saying...
Lippy, smoky eye, that's it.
What I'm saying is Richard Attenborough is often on hand to kind of deliver, like, big paragraphs of, like, Wikipedia to tell us things so that we understand. And he says things like, I've never known England to be weaker than it is now. The treasury is empty. We have France threatening us from one end and Spain threatening us from another. Your Majesty, you must marry someone right now. So, basically, this is the predicament that Elizabeth finds herself in. She's brought onto the throne, but she is the sovereign of a nation that is kind of going down the tubes, and she is a young girl. No one has any faith in her ability to kind of master anything. She's got all these men arrayed around her, not just Attenborough, but also Christopher Eccleston, Joseph Fiennes, and ultimately Geoffrey Rush as well. And they're all kind of vying to control her and also to get her to marry. Now, can you just explain, Sean, like, why the idea of Elizabeth marrying is so fraught throughout the film, and why it causes so much drama?
Well, basically, it was unprecedented at the time to have a female monarch kind of leading unmarried.
Well, I mean, because as a female royal, certainly at that time, what is your primary function?
Yeah, your primary function is to reproduce. So if she married, that means her husband would be the one to decide things. And then ultimately, it would be the heir who would decide things. So she kind of removes herself from any kind of authority.
Yeah, so she's in this predicament. Should she marry Vincent Cassel, who's the Duke of Anjou from France? Should she accept the offer from the King of Spain? Or should she go with sweet, sweet, gorgeous, big-nosed, long-faced, red-lipped Joseph Fiennes.
Now, can we get it over and done with why she can't marry him? Yeah, we find out 3/4 way through the film that he's already married, so that
Well, I think he's already married. He's also kind of lower station,
yeah.
And they say that he's been a traitor in the past. I mean, he's kind of a raffish sort of pretty boy character who's probably not the type of man who should be marrying one of the major sovereigns of a European power.
No.
But she is basically in love with him, and that is very much telegraphed to us from the first appearance of Elizabeth, right? Do you remember, like, we've been spending all that time with Kathy Burke as the, like, dour troll in a dank bat cave, and then we cut to, like, a gorgeous pastoral scene.
Yes, yeah, so like, pre-Raphaelite girls frolic through the fields.
They're doing, like, Morris dancing around a maypole or something. And there's beautiful Joseph Fiennes with his, you know, doublet all unbraced and his chest hair showing.
Elizabeth, Queen of England. A court to worship you. A country to obey you. Poems written celebrating your beauty. Music composed in your honor, and they will be nothing to you. I will mean nothing to you.
Oh, how could you ever be nothing to me? Robert, you know you're everything to me.
Have you paid much attention to Joseph Fiennes in the past, Sean?
Well, we were in a scene together once.
Were you really?
Yes, we were.
Tell us what that was in.
On the cancelled TV show Camelot. I was an extra. It was my summer job.
Were you the fluffer or something?
You're funny, aren't you? I was the oldest of the young knights in training. Like I always tend to be these days.
Did you have any lines?
No, I didn't have any lines.
Did you get to interact with Joseph Fiennes?
Yeah, you get to see me like kind of like be surprised that he's found Excalibur or something.
Wow. Everybody.
Like he gave me a piece of chicken.
I wonder what that was about. Everybody go look that up on the recesses of the internet. Obviously, Ralph Fiennes is the much bigger star. You know, like, Joseph is to Ralph as, like, Jolie Richardson is to Natasha.
Or Vanessa Redgrave.
Or, you know, as Lynn Redgrave is to Vanessa Redgrave, yeah. Right? It's the sort of lesser sibling. However, the year that Elizabeth came out, Joseph Fiennes was the sexy male lead of 2 Best Picture nominees set in Elizabethan times. He's Sir Robert Dudley in this, and he plays none other than William Shakespeare in Shakespeare in Love. So he was your, like, go-to man for hunky, Elizabethan, sensitive, pretty boys.
I wonder why his career faltered.
I just think people didn't think he had the range. He is very attractive to look at. You know, I have to say more than one person has noted a resemblance between Joseph Fiennes and someone that we know well.
It's you. It's you when you're younger, though, I have to say.
Do you think I actually look a bit
like
Joseph
you're younger,
Fiennes?
Yes, you do. You're slender out of long faces and similar necks and possibly the eyes. But you are much more kind of North African than he is.
Well, he did, you know, recently have an ill-fated attempt to play Michael Jackson.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah,
so. Who was not North African, we should point out.
Yeah. So anyway, she can't marry Robert Dudley, even though, I mean, the hanky-panky that goes on between them.
Yeah, she was
like,
no virgin queen, that's for sure.
Like, we obviously know Elizabeth as the virgin queen, and this movie is kind of clearly telegraphing to us from the start, like, this is not your grandmother's Queen Elizabeth I, right? She's gonna do a lot more than Morris dancing and hand clapping. She's gonna get up in the bodice of this guy. They're gonna be whispering, they're gonna be giggling, they're gonna be carousing, and they're really gonna have sex. Like, the movie makes it really clear Elizabeth and Robert Dudley have had sex. Now, we'd have to get some sort of actual Elizabethan expert on here to confirm. A lot of people said that Elizabeth, you know, favored Robert Dudley. I don't know if all this hanky-panky was just created for the movie. Do you care whether or not this movie is historically accurate?
I don't care about the sex lives of Protestants, darling. I think it's perfectly fine to fictionalize something that was probably heavily fictionalized for history.
That's probably true.
Yes, there are historical documents. Yes, Jesus existed. He was a man. Okay.
But he was a Marxist revolutionary is what he was.
But like everything, like every single thing, as time goes on, you just said yourself, history is written by the victors. So whatever we have of Elizabeth, I'm sure, is based in truth. And then was fantasized for the people.
But let's be honest, there are some movies that make you feel like, okay, I've really understood what it must have been like to actually live at this time and to kind of...
Like BPM, which we love.
Yes. Granted, that was only about 30 years ago, as opposed to like 430. But, you know, there are movies that really get us into the mindset of a long ago time. And then there are movies that are essentially soap operas with people wearing frilly collars. I would say that Elizabeth is the latter category, and that maybe is what makes it a fun movie to watch.
Oh, completely. It reminds me of Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I know I've said about 5 different times in the course of this podcast, but it's because it is so decadent, it is so colourful, and doesn't back down for a second.
Can we just say, like, some of the outrageous things that happen? So, like...
Well, I mean, just the editing, the cuts, you know? There's often times where she is filmed through a blood-red lace curtain. When she's crowned queen and she takes the sovereign ring, it has these huge just flash... It fades into white, you know? A bit like in... Age of Innocence, where it just fades into, like, colour. Mm. You know, if someone gets murdered or killed, it's completely over the top as
like
well.
The blood red. Yeah. There's a bit where, in a battle in Scotland, in Edinburgh, like, literally bright red blood is flowing through the river. Yeah. Yet again, a BPM reference, but in this case, it's much more gory.
The camera swoops and sweeps just around everybody in every single situation.
Yep. And it also has, like, a range of character actors, some of whom are the expected candidates. It's like, you know, Attenborough and Geoffrey Rush. And then there's like a professional footballer who shows up at one
point. Yeah, so you call him a, quote, professional footballer.
I have no idea who
okay,
this person
Eric Cantona was the greatest footballer of the 1990s. Played for Manchester United. He was French. He was sexy. My dad loved him. I loved him.
For different reasons.
But he also then quit football to become an actor to various varying success. He was in that film Looking for Eric, which is directed by Ken Loach. I think he was good. I think he was fine in this.
I mean, he's basically an emissary from France who's kind of done up. And he really does stand out. If you say, like, in fact, all the French characters in this movie, you already mentioned how Fanny Ardant just basically looks like a woman you'd, like, run into in the Marais today.
Yeah.
Like, Eric Cantona just looks like some guy that you'd see, you know, on the Jeux de Stade calendar. But, you know...
You might see him down the Marais as well.
He's just got a little, like... He's got a little, like, funny mustache, like, pasted on him. And then Vincent Cassel is there as well. Like, I guess what I'm saying about the movie's kind of inauthenticity, like, I'm sure historians were, like, rolling their eyes left and right at the ludicrousness of this baroque, over-the-top representation of the history.
Yeah, if you want something that's a bit more accurate while still fictionalized, go and check out Dana Jackson's Elizabeth R series, which was made for the BBC in the 70s. I've seen a couple of episodes of it, which actually stood me in good stead for seeing this, because I knew what was happening at the very start.
Well, and of course, a lot of actresses have played Elizabeth I over time. Glenda, very famously in that TV version. Betty Davis has done it. Helen Mirren has done it.
Judi Dench, of course.
Judi Dench, of course, did it the very same year in Shakespeare in Love, but playing a much older Elizabeth.
Oh, so they were nominated for the same character in the same year.
Yes, darling.
That's good trivia for you now, Oscar
listeners.
It's
very good trivia. Can you name any other people?
Yes, it's Titanic.
True? Yeah, Titanic, and also another example. Also with Judi Dench.
Oh,
and also with Kate Winslet.
Oh, Iris.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, but in both those instances, they were playing the same character in the same film,
yeah.
The older and younger versions, whereas this was the same character in two different films in the same
Interesting.
Year. I feel like most of the actresses who play Elizabeth, they tend to play her sort of later in their career and later in her life when they're playing the kind of imperious, monarchical, steely virgin queen. And so therefore, Cate Blanchett appearing as this kind of ruddy-faced, unformed young girl is a really interesting take on Elizabeth. Now, it makes sense because she is still a princess who has yet to ascend to the throne when we first meet her. And actually, Cate Blanchett was a virtual unknown to international audiences when she got cast in this role. It's kind of extraordinary that they plucked this Australian. We haven't talked about at all the fact that Cate Blanchett is actually Australian, but is kind of believable being British, being American, being any number of other things.
Yeah, but we'll get onto accents in the next episode.
Yeah, so how do you feel about Cate and her take on Elizabeth the Princess who becomes Elizabeth the Queen?
Well, I think really it often makes sense to bolster a supporting cast with famous people like John Gielgud, Richard Attenborough, as you mentioned, and a whole raft of other people, and put kind of an unknown at the center. You know, that's happened before.
But that unknown has to be someone who really is going to deliver. Like, you could cast an unknown girl who looks vaguely like Elizabeth or is pretty. I mean, there's any number of young British actresses who are in this film, and Emily Mortimer is there, Kelly MacDonald is there. They didn't go on to become Cate Blanchett.
No, they did not.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, there's a kind of meta level where you're watching this film and you're also seeing the ascendance of a woman who becomes a movie star.
It's A Star Is Born, essentially.
It is.
Yeah.
It really is. It's really interesting to see a young Cate Blanchett because she seems very unguarded.
Yeah, so
especially
young.
In the early scenes.
Yeah.
And she's playing that aspect of Elizabeth. Like, she's emotional with Joseph Fiennes. She's kind of nervous as she wears her ermine robes of monarchy for the first time and has to debate and decide, should she go to war, should she not go to war? And we rarely see that really dewy-eyed, innocent Cate Blanchett now at all on screen.
Well, you know what? If I'd have seen this film at the time, I wouldn't have had the same opinions of Cate Blanchett that I had for so long, because this is a great role to show off, you know, how good you are as an actor. And there were moments where I was like, she's being Meryl. Because there's one particular scene in which she has to talk to all the bishops and convince them to adopt the common prayer book and the various Anglican tropes that we have today.
Well, basically what she's asking them to do is to unify the church, right?
Yeah.
She's going to say, we're going to have one Church of England, and the bishops are these kind of yammering, black-clad old white men who really don't think that this girl should be able to dictate theology to them.
Yeah, so before she does this, she's like in her chamber, like basically rehearsing, being like, bishops, I, your anointed sovereign. No. I am your anointed sovereign. I, your anointed sovereign. Oh.
We've not invoked the name of Meryl, but both of us in this scene, and this is the pivotal turning point scene of the film, she's actually learning how to perform as the queen in this scene.
I ask you to pass this act of uniformity, not for myself, but for my people, who are my only care.
Madam, by this act, you force us to relinquish our allegiance to the Holy Father.
How can I force you, Your Grace? I am a woman.
And she ultimately comes up with a strategy where it's not just about being imperious, it's actually also about being slightly sarcastic and jokey with them. So when they're saying, don't worry about unifying the church, why don't you get married? And she says something like, some would have me marry France, some would have me marry Spain, some say no foreigners at all. What shall I do? Shall I marry one of each? You know, and they all sort of chuckle and laugh, and she plays up the role of being the one woman in the room, in a room full of men. And she finds a way to be disarming and yet to be authoritative and powerful. You can't help but think, frankly, of Meryl practicing with Denise as the Iron Lady.
In one of the worst Oscar-winning films of all time.
Yes, certainly one of the worst Oscar-winning films of all time, but the dynamic is quite similar. We watch as she learns how to present herself in an authoritative way. You know, Meryl does something similar in The Post, right? As Catherine Graham, we watch an older woman who is not used to being authoritative kind of ascend into her decisive decision-making role and stand up to a kind of council of male advisors. You know, and this movie is full of kind of like feminist pull quotes where, you know, she ultimately comes to say things like, I may be a woman, but when I want to, I shall have the heart of a man.
For God's sake, you are still my Elizabeth.
I am not your Elizabeth. I am no man's Elizabeth. And if you think to rule, you are mistaken. I will have one mistress here, and no master!
Wait, do you just want to dwell briefly on Meryl versus Kate?
Well, I think Meryl couldn't do this.
Even young Meryl
couldn't do this. No, she couldn't.
1980s Meryl couldn't do this. Why?
She just hasn't got the range for this kind of performance.
Because what?
Because Meryl's not believable as a queen. She's believable as like a witch or an actress who's immortal. You know, I mean, I can buy a Meryl as like a nuclear power station cleaner, or perhaps even a divorcee,
or a coffee plantation owner.
Yes, but Queen, no.
Okay, but why? Like, Meryl certainly seems regal enough. It's actually somehow that I could buy Meryl in the regal bit of it. It's hard to think of her as the like dewy-eyed young girl. You know, I think Cate Blanchett, like, got to this role at exactly the right time, where she didn't have the kind of carapace of movie stardom
like,
encrusting her. Yeah, I was reading that in a book recently, Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. The word carapace appears in that book about 27 times, so I've been dying to use it in real life. Thank you for allowing me,
this
Sean.
Isn't real life. Carry on.
Anyway, Kate is not yet encrusted with everything we know about her, and actually the film becomes about Elizabeth deciding to encrust herself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know, I get it.
Like, I mean, what are the important things she has to do? Yes, she has to stand up to all the Catholic plotting, and it becomes kind of like The Godfather, where she's like whacking off Christopher Eccleston and torturing Daniel Craig and everybody else.
No, this is why I really liked the film. The consolidation of power comes quickly toward the end because she realizes that's the only thing she can do. It's like Elizabeth has tried to unify people. She has tried to find love in a, you know, natural way. And ultimately she realizes that the confines of the role of sovereign, it means she has to make certain decisions, and ultimately she has everyone whacked.
Yeah, she has everybody whacked off. Sorry. What does she have to do with Joseph Fiennes? He's continually disappointing her, even though they've danced a volta
twice.
Noticeably, did you notice that the first time they dance a volta, it's very sexy, they're very in sync, and the second time they dance a volta,
much more aggressive.
Well, also, they're just not in step with each other, and he goes too far. It's hard to date a queen, as we all know. Yeah.
You know, Brian, I have to say, at one point during this film, I did pick up my phone and go onto Wikipedia and look up how many countries today still have monarchies. I turned to you and I said, there's too many countries that have monarchies still today. It's not right. And you were like, okay, babe, just watch the film. But I'm serious. That is my takeaway from all this, is that all monarchies should be abolished, okay? Do you hear me?
And that's the problem with a movie like this, because a movie like this, it makes monarchy seem so fun, so glamorous, so
necessary.
So opera.
Yeah. Yes.
And so we're meant to root for this woman to consolidate power and to essentially create, you know, a kind of theological state.
Monarchies are inherently wrong. They're the same as autocracies, as far as I'm concerned.
They're also just like cult of personality, and that's what I'm saying. Like,
any country that has a monarchy is kidding itself.
But she has to reject anything that has to do with being a real woman, right? She is a real woman who is in love and has desire for Joseph Fiennes, but does she stay with him in the end?
She can't.
So what does happen to Joseph Fiennes?
Well, he doesn't get killed.
Do you remember why?
I'm not entirely sure why, because they come to his home and he's like, he's there and he's ready and he's like, go on, kill me. But what happens?
Well, they've already had a falling out repeatedly about their sexual affair. And he wants to be killed just the way all the other people who've conspired against the queen have been killed. And she says, no, I'm going to keep you around to remind me of how close I came to danger.
Wow.
She's going to keep him alive. He's presumably going to be holding the burning torch of his love for her, and she is going to not see him in private ever again, not be with any other man, and be married only to England.
Yeah.
I mean, they really underline this aspect of the history, really.
Yeah, where she becomes a virgin, she re-virginizes herself.
Yeah, she basically rebrands herself. It's a branding exercise of, like, from being the weak-willed young girl driven by desire, I am now a woman who is, like, so beyond desire. I am an icon for my people. There's literally a scene of her looking at a statue of the Virgin Mary and then, like, painting herself with, like, marble white makeup.
Yeah, I like that part.
You liked it?
Well, I liked that they did it on her hand first, like you would do in a boutique or chemist shop.
Or an airport duty-free lounge.
Of course.
Of course, the free samples.
What's the point of taking a plane if you don't slather on free samples?
Basically, did you like Elizabeth? Was it worth your time?
It was very OTT, and it might have been even a bit too OTT for me, because I was just recoiling, reacting the entire time, being like, oh my god.
Yeah.
I think actually if all films were like this, I probably would watch even more films.
Your eyeballs would just be assaulted by colours and fabrics and Gregorian chants.
I quite like OTT things.
If you want to go O-O-O-T-T, then what you have to do is watch the execrable sequel to this movie.
By the same director.
The same director, Cate Blanchett back again, Elizabeth the Golden Age. That movie is just so bad.
Is it really bad?
I mean, it's just so shockingly bad. Clive Owen shows up as Sir Walter Raleigh.
Yeah.
She defeats the Spanish Armada. She has to deal with Mary, Queen of Scots as well.
Is Joseph Fiennes in it?
If he is, he's not a major character because he wasn't important anymore in Elizabeth's life. But I think part of the reason that Elizabeth the Golden Age isn't interesting as a movie is because by that point, Elizabeth has become basically that inhuman character. I know that it's a standard trope, like we see Michael Corleone as the innocent young guy in Godfather 1, and then by Godfather 2, he's like the boss, yeah? So it could conceivably work, but, like, it brings out all of Cate Blanchett's, like, absolute worst instincts for histrionics.
Yeah.
And in this movie, she's the still center who seems sort of believable and human amidst all the OTT. And in Elizabeth the Golden Age, she is literally, like, leading the charge of camp and over-dramatization.
Now, if you watch the Oscar clip, this has been the stuff of legend for you and me, which you say that the year she was nominated for Elizabeth Golden Age, the clip in which they play is her Oscar clip where she, don't do it, in which, don't do it, close your mouth.
I'll just insert the clip into the podcast later.
Yeah, please, okay.
Tell him if he wants to shake his little fist at us, we're ready to give him such a bite he'll wish he'd kept his hands in his pockets.
You see a leaf fall, and you think you know which way the wind blows. Well, there is a wind coming, madam, that will sweep away your pride.
I too can command the wind, sir! I have a hurricane in me that will strip Spain bare if you dare to try me!
Once it pans to Kate, you said that she kind of goes like, ooh, okay.
She literally grimaces. And this is the thing. So there is somewhere on YouTube a version that someone's like pirated and put on there where you can see the clip followed by Kate's reaction. But even if you watch the official Academy version, you can see her very clearly grimace.
Yeah?
Yeah. She's just like, I showed up, I put on the dress, I came here, I know I'm not going to win, and I have to sit and watch literally the most ridiculous performance I've ever given. So there is at least one other time that an Oscar nominee that I know of is like really visibly unhappy with the performance that they show.
Stanley Tucci for The Lovely Bones.
Yes, like being a creepy pedophile, and he just like looks at the camera like, yes, I too am sorry that this is my one nomination I've ever received. And I think that's the sort of thing that like wins you over to Cate Blanchett, is like, even though she's can be haughty and imperious and have this actressy quality, you kind of know that she goes home to Andrew Upton and she's like, yeah, I slathered on quite a lot of ham today with that Elizabeth Golden Age. God, that was pretty ripe material, you know? And he was probably sitting there being like, wow, what was that, darling? Sorry, I'm engaged in some dramaturgy, just translating Chekhov here. We haven't talked about her marriage to Andrew Upton. Maybe that's an interesting way to conclude. Despite being this huge international film star, like, she is married to a schlubby dramaturg.
You know, people sometimes marry just for love.
It's brilliant. It's great. I mean, Andrew Upton makes Don Gummer seem like Rudolph Valentino. Do you know what I mean? Like, I kind of love it when these big name actresses are just with guys who they clearly just must love, because they're certainly not hunks and they're not like powerful, famous directors. It's great.
Yeah.
So, Cate Blanchett, we love you.
Yeah, we like you a lot. This is my conclusion, is that I like her a lot, I appreciate her. She doesn't, you know, fire up my loins. But that's fine. I'm very, very happy. And actually, this is a total recommendation to watch Elizabeth.
Yeah. Even if you don't like costume dramas.
Even if you don't like Protestantism or Catholicism or costume dramas.
If you'd like to watch at least one lady-in-waiting scream bloody murder because she's wearing a poison dress while copulating.
Well, watch Lorraine Margot, but also watch Elizabeth.
Yes. Okay. So we are going to turn to two different Cate Blanchett films, and indeed two different Cate Blanchett accents.
Yes, we are.
When we look at the next two installments of Cate Blanchett, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy.
Yes, so you can either hear it tomorrow, or perhaps it's already in your feed, so why don't you just keep listening?
It may well be. If you're one of those people who listens to these breathlessly as they've been airing, you'll have to wait at least 24 hours, but don't worry, you can get these films teased on our Twitter account, which is at Broad Appeal Pod.
Yes, and should you want to hear more from us sporadically, Brian's at BA Mullen Speaks, and I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Now, because we are not divinely installed monarchs, we cannot force you to go onto Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating or a review, but you know it is in the best interest of the people if you would please give us 5 stars. If you haven't done that, we really do appreciate it. There have been quite a few new reviews, which I'm very happy about.
Perhaps some new reviews as well, depending on where you're doing it.
So leave us some stars, we'll go consult the Privy Council, and we shall return with 2 more Cate Blanchett installments in short order.
Coming up. Bye.
Bye.